This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Macro Voices episode 22 was recorded on July 14th, 2016. I'm Eric Townsend. Master technician Dick Dixon from Lowry Research will be joining me as today's feature interview guest. We'll be looking at technical indications in equity markets around the globe in the wake of the Brexit referendum. And I think you're going to find Dick's commentary very interesting, as Lowry's has considerable skepticism about the health of today's equity markets, despite the current rally to new all-time highs in the S&P 500.
And I'm Aaron Chan. Our last regular format show was 2 weeks ago, when everyone was expressing dismay at how quickly U.S. equity markets shrugged off Brexit. 2 weeks later, we're at new all-time highs, with E-mini S&P futures touching 2168 early Thursday morning before the cash session opened. Eric, what's your outlook for equities?
Well, I'm coming more and more around to the view that this is kind of the crack-up scenario of a lot of flight capital. The rest of the world is worse than the United States. And as more and more investors figure that out, I think that we're going to see more international capital flows into the United States, strengthening both the U.S. dollar and U.S. equity markets. I don't want to dive too far into that because some of my views are informed by the perspective of today's feature interview. So let's pick up on the equity topic after today's feature interview, and we'll revisit it then.
Sure, let's do that. Well, crude oil has been looking a little weak lately, struggling to stay above $45 for the last few days. What's the outlook for crude?
Wow. We saw a drawdown of 2.2 million barrels of crude oil nationwide this week. That would be modest for this time of year. It's really not a big enough drawdown in order to make room for storage that we're going to need going into fall maintenance season. But holy cow, the real story, Aaron, is in the finished products. Gasoline, billed on inventory, 1.2 million barrels. Distillates, a whopping 4 million barrel build. So that's 5.2 million barrels of builds in finished product inventories against only 2.2 million barrels of drawdown in crude oil inventories. In other words, that's a 3 million barrel net build in petroleum products, and that's smack dab in the middle of summer driving season when it should be going in the other direction. We need big drawdowns this time of year in order to make storage space available going into fall maintenance season, and that hasn't happened. The other thing that I've noticed, in the last couple of weeks, time spreads in West Texas Intermediate crude oil futures have widened dramatically. The good news there, the curve steepener trade that I've described a couple of months ago on this program has been performing incredibly well in the last couple of weeks, making back the losses from my wrong way call on the direction of oil prices back earlier this spring. The thing that I find interesting, though, usually when you see widening in the time spreads, it happens in the front month. We're seeing most of the widening occur in the months around fall maintenance season. That says to me that the market is starting to anticipate a storage crunch come fall maintenance, and that makes perfect sense with the inventory numbers that we're seeing. Bottom line, all indications to me say we need to be really concerned about what happens around fall maintenance. And again, for anyone who's unfamiliar with that, refineries have to reconfigure their equipment every year, twice a year, to go from the summer blend of gasoline to the winter blend of gasoline, and that requires reconfiguring some of the equipment. They shut down for a few weeks, and during that period of time, while they're shut down, they're not consuming crude oil, and that means crude oil being produced during those weeks in the fall season has to be stored someplace, and of course, we're in a very tight storage situation. RBN Energy had an excellent article that we sent you in last week's Research Roundup email, which registered users at macrovoices.com already received. I thought they had an interesting perspective on why we didn't have an outright panic when we went over 90% storage capacity in Cushing. And according to RBN Energy, the reason is if you went back before 2012, if you started to see those kind of stockpiles, remember Art Berman's comments when we had Art on the program saying, in the past, anytime Cushing has gone beyond 85% capacity, then you start to see real problems with prices. Well, the reason is, prior to 2012, if you had more than 85% or 90% capacity in Cushing, Oklahoma, that oil was landlocked. There was no place for it to go because the pipelines used to flow from Houston to Cushing and from Canada down to Cushing. That meant that if that oil didn't get consumed by Midwest refineries, there was no place for it to go. People got very concerned. The market is forward-looking, anticipates a problem, and that caused price pressure. What RBN Energy is saying is, hey, guys, we've got upwards of a million barrels per day of outbound pipeline capacity going from Cushing down to the Gulf Coast because the Seaway pipeline was reversed in 2012. What that means is even if we got to 99% capacity, once people realized, hey, Houston, we've got a problem, pardon the pun, but Houston is the destination they would send that oil to. Houston, we've got a problem. We need to start pipelining oil to you. They could send a million barrels a day if they needed to, and that essentially provides a pressure relief valve on the storage capacity in Cushing. So I like that explanation. Maybe that's the reason we didn't see an outright panic. But we are headed towards a situation this fall where I think storage is going to be a problem again. It's fascinating. You know, we thought this spring that the storage crisis, if it happened, would be around spring maintenance. We figured that by the end of the year, surely by then the market will have rebalanced itself. We won't have this excess production. Looks like we are going to have a problem around fall maintenance season after all.
Well, Eric, it's great to hear that the curve steepener trade is working out for you. Let's shift to precious metals. You opined 2 weeks ago that gold was looking strong in the wake of Brexit, possibly on expectations of exit contagion in Europe, but you said we really needed to watch it and see if it could stay at those levels. So since then, we've seen a move even higher, topping at 1377, but for the last several days, we've seen considerable weakness, with the barbarous relic touching 1320 briefly Thursday morning. So what's going on here? Do you think the rally is out of steam, and is it downhill from here?
Well, I think it's a little bit too early to call it. The question in my mind has been, you know, when you see something like the reaction to Brexit, that number was 1362, was the panic reaction of what gold traded up to. So the question in my mind was, could it actually, after 1362, of course, it corrected back down to below 1350. Could it get back above that 1362 level and stay there? Well, it did get above that level. In fact, it got all the way to 1377, but it didn't stay there. And the question on my mind now is, will it stay above the post-Brexit low, which was 1308? So far it is. We're seeing a bit of a rebound this afternoon on Thursday. But is it going to stay there? So I think the range to watch is 1308 to 1362. If we see it close below 1308, that tells me that maybe CPM Group was right after all, and we're going to see a sell-off, perhaps as low as 1200. On the other hand, a move above 1377 and a sustained move above that level, if it stays above that level for several days, would be extremely bullish. I think the bulls need some news flow, though. If we had news of exit contagion, more countries are going to have referenda to leave the EU, more bad stuff is going to happen. That would be the kind of thing that maybe would get us back above that 1377 level and take us to new highs. It looks to me for now as though it's not going to do that, especially if the dollar index continues to be strong.
So Eric, I'm assuming a move above 1377 before testing 1308 would be a very bullish sign. So what about the US dollar index? Since the Brexit vote, it's been stuck in a fairly narrow trading range between 95.5 and 96.5. So what do you make of the DX chart?
Well, the Fibonacci retracement level, the 61.8 Fib level, is right around 97, and I think that's what's providing resistance right now. I think it probably will break out above that, and it'll accelerate from there, because once you get above that 61.8 Fib retracement, most technicians would tell you it's going to go to 100%, which would be back over 100 on the dollar index, and I think that that would be a signal to a lot of people that the dollar rally is back in force. A little bit too early to call it, as we're still seeing resistance at that key Fib level. I think the big question is whether the international capital flows out of Europe into the United States, which came in the wake of the Brexit referendum, are going to continue or not. If that was just a temporary thing, maybe we've seen all that the dollar is going to do for now and there's going to be a little bit of softness. I don't think it's going to go that way. I think that more likely, especially after the strong jobs report that we saw for June, I think that the Fed rate hike is back in view as a possibility, and that's another factor that could create upward pressure. Once we break through 97, I think the move would accelerate to the upside from there.
And Eric, lastly, we've been watching the 10-year Treasury yield closely for the last few weeks. It finally recovered to above the 150 level this week after touching an all-time low, but the action has been pretty exciting. So what do you see on the horizon for fixed income?
Well, the all-time low was certainly interesting. I think the prior low from summer of 2012 was a closing level of 1.39 and an intraday of 1.36. We saw a close of 1.36 and an intraday of 1.35 in the last couple of weeks. So, you know, I've been predicting for years that that 1.36 all-time low would be retested. It has now been retested. I think we're going eventually to 1% yields on the U.S. 10-year. Does that happen this year? Is that move on now? I thought it was when we got down to that record low. This bounce is pretty impressive back to 150. Can it hold? I don't know. I'm watching it closely. Certainly, if we're going to see a recovery here, the recovery has got to happen now. It's been long enough since the Brexit referendum that we can't keep saying, oh, it's just temporary. So we are seeing some pretty significant strength in the 10-year yield back above 150. If it stays above 150, that's one thing. I think if it starts to fall over, it really sends a strong recession signal to me.
Thanks for the market update, Eric. But before we move on to this week's featured guest, let's take a minute to explain why we're deviating from our usual preference for macro commentators and interviewing a technician this week instead.
Well, this was inspired by Raul Paul's comment in the video that he and Grant Williams published immediately in the wake of the Brexit referendum. We sent our registered users a link to that, I think 3 weeks ago in our research roundup email. And Raul's comment was, you know, this is one of those things where you've got to let markets tell you what it means. All of the pundits are going to be on the TV channels saying, I know exactly what this means. Look, they're guessing. They don't know better than you and I do. We need to let the price signal tell us what this means. And for that reason, I wanted to get a technician on. Lowry Research in particular does a style of technical analysis where they separately measure selling pressure and buying pressure in equity markets. And I wanted to get a sense of what was going on both in the United States and around the world. Lowry's tracks 22 different equity markets around the world. So the motivation for this particular guest this week was to follow Raul's advice and take the pulse of global markets from a technician's perspective. The other thing is we are breaking out to all-time new highs on the S&P. Does that mean that George Soros and Stan Druckenmiller and all these other brilliant guys that have been calling for a major downside event are all wrong? Or does it mean that something else is going on? So I wanted to get a technical perspective on what we should make of the current rally that's underway right now.
That's right, and Mr. Dixon was kind enough to send us some samples of Lowry's recent research notes and presentations, which have already been sent to registered users at macrovoices.com through our free weekly research roundup email. There you'll find links to their most recent market presentations, as well as a link to a free subscription trial. Eric's interview with Mr. Dixon is coming up as Macro Voices continues, right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Master Technician Dick Dixon from Lowry Research. Dick, what I'd like to do is start with the approach that you guys take at Lowry's, because I think some of our listeners may not be familiar with it. How do you guys look at markets?
Okay, well, Mr. Lowry actually started our service in 1938, so we've been around now for close to 80 years. And the approach is really one of supply and demand. We believe that the forces of supply and demand are what drive the market. You have more demand, prices go up. You have more supply, and prices go down. The major vehicle that we use for measuring supply and demand is what probably Lowry's is best known for, which is our buying power and selling pressure indexes. These are based upon your composite figures, things like up-down volume, total volume, and something that is fairly unique to Lowry's. In fact, I think it might be totally unique to Lowry's is points gained and points lost. That is simply a total of all the points gained on the advancing issues on the New York Stock Exchange on a daily basis, and then the points lost is obviously the opposite, the points on all the stocks that have declined on that day. And originally, Mr. Lowry and then later on Paul Desmond, who took over, would go through the stock tables in the Wall Street Journal and accumulate it up. Just look at every stock, every issue that was listed in the stock tables was up or down on the day, and add the points up and points on the advancing issues and points on the declining issues. I've told people that I'm grateful that they computerized it before I got here, because I know who would have gotten that job. And Paul said he got very good at it. At one point, it took him about 3 hours to do. It was on a daily basis. So that's something that is, as I said, a little bit unique to Lowry's, but we think it adds another dimension to our analysis that perhaps can't be found elsewhere.
Now, we wanted to bring you on the program because we're very much of the opinion that you have to listen to markets and what the price signal tells you as far as something like the relevance of this Brexit referendum. So in the case of U.S. equities, if you looked at the S&P futures chart on the night of the referendum, it appeared that World War III had started and the end was nigh. It took just a few days before that had been fully retraced, and just a few weeks before we traded at all-time new highs. So what are your indicators telling you about U.S. equities?
Well, the surprising thing is that even though we're seeing new highs in the price indexes, and particularly the S&P and the Dow Jones, and also in the advanced decline lines, which is another thing that people have been pointing out, the new highs in the New York Composite Advanced Decline Line dating back to, I guess, the beginning of April. But our measures of supply and demand, you know, buying power and selling pressure, really are not confirming that whatsoever. For instance, at the February low, which obviously was about 20% or so below where the S&P is right now, our selling pressure index was at 277. Today, even though we've had this huge rise in the market, the selling pressure is at 258, which is, if my arithmetic is correct, 19 points below where it was when the S&P back in February was at, 1,700 or so, something like that. Unfortunately, I have a Dow chart up here. The Dow was at 15,660 on February 11th. And, today, the Dow's trading at 18,523. It's a bit higher than it was back then. So there has been a nominal decrease in selling. At the same time, our buying power index, you'd say, well, the market has got to be powered by strong demand. On February 11th, our buying power index was at 145. As of yesterday, it was at 137. So you actually had a drop in selling pressure of 8 points, in buying power of 8 points during this entire rally. This is not consistent with a healthy bull market. Taking it on a longer-term trend basis, buying power started to trend lower, clearly lower in April last year, April of 2015. Selling pressure at the same time started to trend higher, and that has not changed. You're still seeing a higher, a trend upward in selling pressure, a trend downward in buying power. It's interesting that this trend has occurred while the market has been trading in a range. People sort of recognize that the Dow and the S&P, NASDAQ, have been trading in a range, or had been trading in a range for the Dow and the S&P, dating back to the beginning of 2015, really. Now you have apparently broken out from that range. Historically, trading ranges can represent one of two things. They either appear to accumulation, where people are using that as an opportunity to accumulate stock positions, or it can be a period of distribution where you're seeing, you know, the old saying, stock being going from strong hands into weak hands. People who bought at much lower prices now selling to people who are buying at considerably higher prices. So, you know, are you seeing distribution or accumulation? Well, buying power and selling pressure are very useful vehicles in that they tell you the trends of supply and the trends of demand. Well, during this trading range, what we've seen? Well, we've seen a trend of rising supply and falling demand, which, needless to say, makes us a little bit cautious about this breakout that we've just had in the Dow and the S&P.
Now, how do we resolve or account for this dichotomy? Because as you're saying, you've got very well-tested indicators that are telling you that really the opposite of what's happening should be happening. How do we resolve that? What does past history teach you? And particularly, one theory that I have is that I wonder if what we're seeing is just a lot of flight capital coming into the United States from other countries, because the picture is getting worse outside the United States more quickly than it is inside the United States. Does any of the indications that you're looking at confirm or refute that idea?
No, nothing really refutes it. It's difficult to see a confirmation other than the fact that, you know, the idea that money, it may be coming in from abroad, yet you're seeing selling going on here, perhaps. So this could, again, be the sort of the greater fool theory that you're seeing a lot of equity flows or a lot of money flows coming in globally into our market, but which, by the way, historically has occurred at terminal points in bull markets. Generally, when you see a very high, historically, a very high inflow of foreign money coming in our market, it occurs not at the beginning, at the end of a bull market. So I would not regard that as a positive sign for the market. But the thing, obviously, that is unique about this market environment is the consistently very low, nearly zero interest rate policy that we have. And you know, that result in what they now are calling the TINA market. You know, there is no alternative to equities, given the yields you're seeing on defensive areas like the utilities, consumer staples, telecom stocks, which have consistently led the market. You've had brief periods where things like energy materials have taken place, but the most consistent leadership really has been in these high dividend paying stocks. So you have a dynamic going on that is really very unusual based upon the very low interest rates that and the very low yields that you're going to find anywhere. My take on this is that you have a lot of people coming into the market right now who historically would not be in the market. And I kind of make that as a comparison to what you had, believe it or not, back in 1999. Where you had a lot of people in the market who normally would not be in the market. Now, they were in for different motivations. Obviously, they were day trading. They were seeing, you know, these huge gains that you had in these dot-com stocks. So, you know, people were giving up their day jobs to day trade. And I personally knew a couple people who did just that. They gave up their day job. They're just day trading. So you had a lot of people in the market who didn't belong in the market, but there you are. Now, today, I think you have a lot of people in the market who would not normally be in the market. You have mom and pop who just got, you know, their CD just matured, and they might have had a 4 or 5% return on their, you know, 10-year CD or something. And now they come into the market and they say, oh, well, you know, 10 years, you know, we can get you about maybe 0.75%. They say, what? And he said, well, you know, see, you know, old Bob over here, you know, in the brokerage branch of our bank. And old Bob says, well, I can get you, you know, I can get you, you know, Florida Power and Light, or Xterra, as they call it down here, Dominion Power, Southern Company, Duke Power, you know, all blue chip companies, or I can get you Disney, I can get you Coke, I can get you Pepsi, I can get you General Mills, Johnson & Johnson, blue chip companies, and they're paying 3 or 4% in their dividends. What do you want? Oh, well, let's see. I can get 0.75% in the CD, or I can buy a blue chip stock and get 3.5-4% dividend. What should I do? So, you know, you have people in the market who normally would not be in the marketplace. And that, I think, is a dangerous thing, ultimately, because they don't know how to react once the market does start going down. And eventually it will go down. When? Who knows? But eventually it's going to happen. Valuations get to a certain level, and the compunction to sell. You see it to a little degree, and just briefly, in just last week or earlier this week, when you saw that the defense of utilities and telecoms were lagging. They were, you know, so some profit taking there. When you look at the valuations of these stocks, it gets to be crazy. But that's what we got.
Well, certainly the focus on dividend-paying stocks indicates that capital that's perhaps looking for yield as opposed to traditional equity investors are in the market. And whether that be day traders or flight capital coming from other countries, it's probably hard to discern. But it certainly seems to confirm the idea that what's going on here is not your typical equity up move. Let's move to ground zero for the Brexit referendum, which of course would be the FTSE 100. We've seen the weakness in the pound sterling has continued, but a pretty good rebound in terms of the FTSE 100. What are you seeing there?
You know, we do our buying power and selling pressure indexes for all the foreign countries that we cover, and that includes the UK. And one of the things that is, I guess, consistent is just like we have in the U.S., we're seeing what I would characterize as a very poor balance of supply and demand. Now, it's been fairly widely reported that the FTSE 100 actually has performed pretty well. If you look at the graph of the FTSE, it also appears to have performed a breakout. In this case, after a fairly prolonged decline, it's been trading sideways since last August or September, and it has broken to a new high, a new breakout high. Whereas the mid-cap and the small-cap indexes in the UK are well short. They have rallied, and they've actually been a little bit of catch-up over the last 3 or 4 days to gains in the FTSE, but nonetheless, they have not broken out to the same degree. So I think the thinking was that the small and mid-caps are much more domestically oriented, whereas you have the international orientation towards many of these stocks in the FTSE 100, which may not have been affected as much by the by this Brexit. So then the question becomes, okay, how does this breakout look? Does it look valid? And that's where we look at the buying power and selling pressure. And, you know, what's fascinating is that really dating back to the middle of June, around June 16th or so, there has been a, not quite a spectacular, but a very sharp rise in the buying power index. It's gone from 440 up to yesterday's 502. Doesn't mean a whole lot to anybody, but you can see the kind of gain that you've had. Over the same period of time, though, selling pressure actually is shown a modest, very modest drop. It's gone from 462 to yesterday's 450, so it's down 12 points. And it has been as high as, 478 or so. So there has not been anywhere near as much of a contraction in supply as there has been an expansion in demand. So in other words, just put it in plain terms, yeah, there's been a lot of buying, but there's also been a lot of selling going on underneath the surface. And again, that is not normally the sign of a healthy market. Now, you might say, well, a lot of that selling was in the small and mid-caps. Okay, fine. How is that a positive sign, though, for the market overall, if the buying is focused on a relatively small number of stocks? You know, in this case, some stocks, probably not all stocks, in the FTSE 100. That sort of undermines the kind of strength that you're seeing, or the apparent strength that you're seeing in the FTSE. We also do advanced decline lines for each one of these market segments. And, you know, again, you can see the advanced line for the FTSE 100 has moved to a new high. The advanced decline line for the small cap index, however, is still lingering very close to its 12-month lows. So you're not, it's a very, very selective rally, and historically that has not been a sign of a healthy market. So I would regard that breakout in the FTSE as very, very suspicious. I guess I'd be very skeptical about its sustainability.
Well, and certainly that echoes what you said about the S&P back in the United States. As we move beyond the UK to the rest of Europe, what are your indicators telling you about the rest of Europe? And I'm particularly interested in countries like Italy and Spain that have been cited as perhaps the most likely or the most dangerous if they were to follow in Britain's footsteps and consider exiting the European Union.
Yeah, well, let's think of Italy first, which is absolutely the basket case. You have had very modest rallies in all three. Again, we look at the FTSE Italia MIB index, which is our large cap index. We also look at the mid and small cap indexes there. And all three of them have bounced about the same. Actually, you've probably seen a little bit larger bounce in the small and mid cap indexes than in the large cap index. Nonetheless, you know, what's been supporting these bounces? And, well, in this case, one of the things we look at is which is dominant, which is at above the other. Is buying power dominant or is selling pressure dominant? And, obviously in the U.S., selling pressure is dominant right now. Most of the European countries, buying power is dominant by a relatively small margin, except Italy. And in Italy, Italy is a case where not only has demand gone up, but supply has gone up as well. Which is a very negative sign. That there's been selling, but buying, but there has been an increase in selling, not just steady selling, as you might see with sort of a sideways movement in selling pressure, but an increase in selling. How much is this focused on banks, for instance, which are really basket cases? I don't know, but it's a very negative sign in what you're seeing in Italy right now. Just to give you another instance, right now you have about 65% of the stocks in Italy that are trading in intermediate-term downtrends right now. So basically two-thirds of the stocks in Italy right now are trending lower on an intermediate-term basis. We're looking at 150-day moving average in this case. Italy looks very, very weak. Moving on to Spain, Spain is doing a bit better. They had that election, a couple of weeks ago, and they were worried about some kind of nationalist power coming in or nationalist party coming in, and they went with a sort of a moderate conservative group, and that I think sort of helped. But again, like in Italy, the mid and small cap indexes are rallying the most. All remain well below their highs from back in April and May. So again, unlike what you were seeing in the FTSE 100. And in terms of our measures of supply and demand, it's a similar situation. Yes, demand has gone up, although it's been stalling lately, even though prices have moved to a higher high here in the last couple of days from their initial recovery high back at the beginning of July. Buying power has not made a new high. Selling pressure has not made a new low. In fact, selling pressure on a short-term basis is trending higher as well. So you're seeing bounces, and this is really the case really across the whole region where, you're seeing some demand, but you're also seeing selling coming into the market. Not quite offsetting the amount of demand since the prices have gone up. Nonetheless, it's not a healthy balance of supply and demand. You'd like to see supply going down, obviously demand going up, and a healthy rally. You're not seeing that. So this, I think, makes us very cautious about the sustainability of these rallies. These, quite frankly, look much more like rebound rallies from those Brexit lows than really the start of any kind of sustained move higher.
And this weakness in Italy and Spain, has it been fairly coincident with the lead up to and then the vote in Brexit? Does it appear that there's a correlation with this between this weakness and the potential that these countries might follow in Britain's footsteps?
Yeah, well, if you look at, we'll take a look at buying power and selling pressure. You go back to really the end of April when buying power really peaked and selling pressure dropped, and it was a recovery high. We have basically marked across the globe, bottomed back in mid-February, and had rallies. And they topped about the same time. The S&P topped April 20th. This top was April 27th. Buying power then plummeted and selling pressure stayed about constant. It had a very modest decline, but basically it was just moving sideways. So, you know, you had a total, evaporation of demand. I'm looking at the Spanish buying power now. It went from 379 to on June 14th down to 315. So you had a very sharp drop there, and you know, obviously that predated the Brexit decision. Italy, basically, this is really in May. May 9th is when buying power topped. You had been in a rally, again, dating back to February. Buying power topped, then dropped sharply. At the same time, selling pressure rose. So buying power trended lower until that Brexit, actually just before the Brexit low. It actually bottomed on June 16th and then started climbing. Selling pressure, though, has been climbing the whole time, dating back to the middle of May. So you actually had a rise in supply and a drop in demand up until about the middle part of June, just prior to the Brexit vote. And then you had a jump in demand, but also a continued rise in supply. So in Italy, at least, you certainly did not see any signs. You did see signs of weakening prior to that Brexit vote.
And if we move on to countries such as, let's say, Germany, which are considered by most people not to be likely to immediately follow Britain's footsteps and mount a campaign to leave the European Union, does the picture look different there?
No, that's the thing. In fact, Germany probably looks a little bit worse in the sense that you did have, in some of these other countries, at least you did have a fairly nice rise in buying power. In this case, buying power, going back to the Brexit low, has shown just a nominal increase. And selling pressure is up as well. Selling pressure is clearly trending higher, and that trend dates back to the beginning of June. And buying power is actually lower than it was back in the beginning of June. So there is no indication of an improving market. If anything, it's a weakening market condition in Germany. Given the rise in selling pressure is significantly more over the last month than the rise in buying power. So you're actually seeing more selling going on than buying. And if you look at the spread between buying power and selling pressure, let's see, I'll just say some quick math here. There was a spread back on June 8th of 30 points. Currently, the spread is 10 points. So you can see that relationship, or if you want to call it the balance of supply and demand, over the last month has grown considerably worse.
Any other particularly interesting points in European markets before we move on to the rest of the world?
One of the things that I found kind of fascinating is that in the looking at sectors, for instance, in Europe, one of the strongest sectors here, obviously, from time to time, is in energy. You have had a lot of bargain hunting in energy, and since the beginning of the year, energy has been one of the better performing industry sectors here. In Europe, it is perhaps the worst performing sector. Certainly, regionally, energy, telecom, and energy are the two worst performers. Looking at the two major economies that are left, France and Germany, it's energy and basic materials. And in Germany, it's technology and basic materials that are the worst performers. But globally, energy has been one of the weakest areas weakest sectors in the market, which is, I find interesting in that that's contrary to what we've had in the U.S. I'm not exactly sure what to make of that, but I just found that interesting.
And as we move on to Asia, obviously China is experiencing some pretty significant economic problems, and Japan may even be considering helicopter money stimulus at this point. So what are you seeing in those markets?
Unfortunately, we're not seeing anything that's particularly exciting in any of those. Let's take China first and look at that. China is somewhat of an enigma. I'm not too sure if it's just because of the reporting, or exactly what it is, but Now, buying power and selling pressure are acting okay in China. Really, since the beginning of June, you've had a modest uptrend in buying power. You also have had a modest downtrend in selling pressure. As a matter of fact, selling pressure is currently at its lowest level, really, of the, I don't know how far back I could go, but certainly the last 12 months. So you're not seeing much selling going on there. The issue there is that most of the strength seems to be in the small cap and in the mid cap area. If you look at the advanced decline lines, for instance, of these three market segments, both the small cap advanced decline line and the mid cap advanced decline line are at new highs. The large cap advanced decline line is not, which is kind of the opposite of what you're seeing in most other countries, where it's large cap that's been leading the way. And we take us back to what's going on in the UK right now, where large cap is doing the best. So it's a little bit of a strange market. We're really kind of unsure of exactly how to analyze it, but just looking at it on the surface, it actually looks pretty good. There's not a lot that we can point to if these indicators, and we're a little bit suspicious about them given the kind of apparent manipulation that occurs in their market, as to how useful or how accurate these indicators are. I don't want to downplay it, but at the same time, we do have questions about this. In fact, we have debated whether or not we should even cover China in the sense that, how accurate is this data that's coming out of China. If it is accurate, then the market looks fine. So, that's the bottom line. Japan, where there is no such problem, I think we can count on the data coming out of there. Unfortunately, it looks terrible. You have had a bit of a bounce. Yeah, they were talking about the helicopter money. Unfortunately, in terms of the measures of supply and demand, just not there. It was kind of interesting that when they first announced their negative interest rates, which I guess was back in February, right, we had a one-day rally out of it, and it just sort of went sideways. And that's been sort of the history here over the last 6 months or so, that you get these announcements, you get a brief bounce, and then nothing. And as a result, you have Japan trading far below its highs, even its recovery highs from last year, far below those. And you're not seeing any kind of an improvement in terms of the balance of supply and demand, buying power and selling pressure. I say the two of them are doing a little bit of a do-si-do here, because one becomes dominant, then the other becomes dominant, and that's been just, they've been just crossing back and forth really since the middle part of June with no clear trend. So, the market's trying to rebound, but you're certainly not seeing it accompanied by any kind of a sustained move higher, either in supply or demand. Now, with the market rallying, obviously the lack of an expansion in demand and the lack of a contraction in supply is not a good thing, suggesting there's very little support for this bounce. So there's just not a lot there in Japan that's encouraging.
Now, as we move on to the rest of Asia, one of the views that has been expressed by a number of people is that emerging markets are going to be dramatically put at risk because the Brexit is going to result in a lot of flight capital into the U.S. dollar and strengthening of the U.S. dollar, making it difficult for those developing economies to repay debt that's denominated in U.S. dollars. Are you seeing any indications in equity markets that would either confirm or refute that viewpoint?
The emerging markets really are a mixed bag. We don't cover that many of them. We cover India, Brazil, South Korea, Taiwan, we're just not seeing any consistency. India doesn't look bad. India probably looks the strongest of these emerging markets that we cover. You've had a very, very strong expansion in buying power in this rally, and obviously you're looking at recovery highs in, I believe, all the market indexes right now, large, mid, and small. The Nifty CNX Nifty Index, the BSE 500 Index, and their what they call their Nifty Midcap 50 Index, which we call their small cap, all recovery highs. And, you know, you've had a very nice increase in buying power. I guess the one cautionary factor is that there has not been an equivalent drop in selling pressure, but selling pressure nonetheless has trended lower, and so, you know, we're kind of trying to find good things where we can. And, you know, selling pressure has been trending lower since the latter part of February, and buying power has been trending higher, clearly. So, you know, this is a different pattern than we're seeing in other markets, including the U.S. So, you know, I have to say that things look pretty positive in India. Now, having said that, it is a very selective rally. If you look at the advanced decline lines, clearly the large cap stocks are benefiting the most. The mid cap and the small cap in particular, you're seeing very little, if any, increase in the advanced decline line dating back to those February reaction lows in the market. Matter of fact, it looks like the small cap advanced decline line may be about the same level it was back in February. So the rallies in the mid and small cap, even though the indexes look pretty good, are going to be based, again, these are cap weighted, so it's going to be on the relatively few of the small cap and mid cap. You know, I guess it would be the larger capitalizations in those mid and small caps that are helping those indexes climb higher. So, you know, the Indian market on the surface looks good, the balance of supply and demand looks good, but it also is a very, very selective market, so you have to be very careful if you're going to be investing in India.
As we look at the rest of the world, whether it be Australia, New Zealand, wherever else, do you see anything noteworthy or anything that appears to be in reaction to Brexit that might give us some insight into capital flows around the world?
You know, again, it's been a mixed bag. I mean, I'm looking at Australia right now, and you know, you've had a nice rally in Australia. In fact, again, here you were looking at trading ranges, kind of like what you had in the UK for the large cap. And this would be the ASX 200, the mid-cap and the small-cap. Actually, the mid-cap is outperforming the large-cap and the small-cap by a pretty wide margin. So you've had nice rallies. So you've had rallies to new recovery highs in all three of those. Now, I don't know if this is on, you know, rallies in commodities. Obviously, it's a fairly commodity-sensitive market. But you know, again, here though, you know, you're really not seeing that much of a positive balance in supply and demand. Yes, you have had a rise in buying power and a drop in selling pressure during this post-Brexit rally. Prior to that, though, you know, you had a pretty significant drop in buying power. In fact, you took out an uptrend dating back again to February by a pretty wide margin. And the same thing with selling pressure. Selling pressure was trending higher. Right up to that Brexit low. So, you know, going into Brexit, you had a pretty good expansion in supply, a pretty good contraction in demand. Since then, yes, you have had a reversal. Doesn't look like the expansion in buying, though, is equivalent to the kind of rise that you've had in prices. It's fallen short. You know, the price, for instance, in the large cap ASX is just about back up to where it was back in mid-May, I guess, whereas the buying power index is far below where it was in mid-May, and selling pressure is far above where it was in mid-May, so you're not seeing a commensurate move in buying power or selling pressure. So again, there, you know, yes, you've had a nice move up in the price indexes, but are you seeing the kind of strengthening in demand and drop-off in supply that you'd expect to see in a sustained rally or the early stages of a sustained rally? Answer again, there is no. So, you know, this has been a, you know, with the exception of the, you know, China and maybe to a lesser extent India, this has been a constant pattern throughout the world, which is one reason why we are concerned about the markets. It's not something that's isolated in the U.S. Yes, there have been nice price rallies in these global markets, but what kind of support are you seeing behind it? In terms of expanding demand and contracting supply, and the answer is not much.
Well, it sounds as I assimilate what you said about all these markets for a variety of different reasons, and I don't want to put words in your mouth here, but it sounds like you're almost calling the whole global reaction to Brexit a dead cat bounce. Okay, yes. It's a very quick yes. So what other, do you think that this is it? Do you think we're at a blow-off top point here where, it's time to get very bearish, or do you think that maybe there's room for these rallies to continue from here? What's it look like?
Well, as I said in the daily comment yesterday, you've had on an intraday basis from the low, that June 27th low, the Brexit low, to yesterday's high, you had a 9.5% gain in the Dow, about 8% something in the S&P. That's over 11 days. So, you basically crammed a very nice annual return into about 2 weeks' time. With that kind of explosive move up, you would think, okay, have prices moved high enough to generate any significant selling? Yesterday was a pretty clear answer to that, and it is no. There was virtually no selling going on. Yeah, you saw a little bit. NASDAQ was down a bit. S&P was essentially flat. Small mid-caps are down a little bit. But it's nothing, considering the kind of rally that we've had over a very short period of time. So that suggests that, guess what? Prices probably have to go higher to really reach a level that is going to generate some profit taking. So, our conclusion last night was this rally likely has further to run. And here you got the Dow up another 138 points today. Are you going to reach a euphoria level where people are climbing over one another to buy stocks? You're seeing the sentiment readings, 15% bull, 60% bear. 15% bears, 60% bulls. I don't know. We did a report a couple of weeks ago saying euphoria can take different forms. And looking at the willingness of people to buy some of these defensive stocks that are trading at multiples that are far above their historic averages. Utilities, for instance. I think we were looking at the utilities in our database, and I think we came out with an average of about 30 times earnings. And we got some comments from our clients saying, well, Bloomberg shows us like 23 or 24 times earnings. My response to that is, well, if the historic is 14, what difference does it make if it's trading at 23 or 30? It's still at a large premium to historic levels. Might that represent sort of a different form? I said that this market may not end in euphoria. It may just end in desperation, that people are so desperate for yield. They don't care what the valuations are. Just buy me a 3% yield. It's trading at 30 times earnings. Huh? Who cares? I want the 3% yield. At some point in time, those valuations are going to come into play. At some point, that's the sticking point there. Where's that point? Who knows? But that's where we're going right now with this market. And it's, as many people have said, it's not going to end well. When's it going to end? That's the question, isn't it?
That sure is. Well, Dick, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your perspective on the market. I want to change gears completely here and ask a question in a different direction. For our listeners who are interested in learning more about technical analysis, do you have a favorite book or resource for learning about technical analysis?
Well, one of the favorite books is Edwin LeFay's Reminiscence of a Stock Operator, which is supposedly about Jesse Livermore. Just sort of a primer on technical analysis, I would suggest Charlie Kirkpatrick's book. It's Charles Kirkpatrick and Julie Dalquist. It's called Technical Analysis, The Complete Resource for Financial Market Technicians. It's pretty comprehensive. I'm not sure if it might be a little bit advanced. Another is John Murphy's book, Technical Analysis of Financial Markets. Either one of those, I would say, would be a good starting point. But if you want to sort of get the flavor behind it, you can't beat Lefebvre's book on Livermore.
Well, I certainly agree with that. It's a favorite of mine. Before we close, I know that you offer these analysis services to your institutional clients in 22 different equity markets around the world. So please give our listeners a little bit more sense of exactly what you do at Lowry Research and where they can find out more about it.
Well, what we do is we provide really daily information on the U.S. markets. On the global markets, we have weekly analysis on each one of these markets as far and as well as the overall global and region for the Asian region, the European region. All this is available on our websites. Lowry On Demand is the domestic website. We cover the New York and we cover NASDAQ. And Lowry Global is our website for the global markets. And that can also include the U.S. market. As I said, our analysis is strictly based on the laws of supply and demand. We follow, our weekly institutional report. I guess we have about 120 different indicators that we make commentaries on. So we're not just strictly sticking with buying power and selling pressure. We have a complete set of indicators that we use in analyzing the U.S. markets and the global markets. Most of those same indicators are applied to the global markets as well.
Well, thanks so much, Dick. It's been a fantastic interview. Aaron Chan and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at MacroVoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
It's fascinating that Mr. Dixon is so skeptical of global equity markets based on technical indications, even in the face of the current rally to new all-time highs. Eric, what's your take on the equity situation after hearing Mr. Dixon's observations as a technician?
Well, I've very much come around to the view that what's going on here is markets are figuring out that the situation in Europe, regardless of the Brexit and whether or not Italy follows in their footsteps or not, well, one way or another, the picture in Europe is dire. We had a major sovereign debt crisis in 2012 that was averted by, frankly, papering over our problems and extending and pretending. The ECB has gotten away with printing trillions of euros in order to paper over problems, but that's a temporary solution. It didn't solve any problem at its root cause. Europe has been addicted to spending beyond its means on borrowed money in order to fund their socialism programs, frankly, for 50 years now. And I think that it's coming to an end. You know, you eventually run out of someone else's money to spend, as Margaret Thatcher famously said. And I think that we're getting there. So I think that what's going on is markets are starting to realize Europe is really in trouble. China is really in trouble. Japan is really hurting. That means that there will be significant international capital flows out of the rest of the world into the United States. And what I see is this reinforcing reflexive mechanism that first you get flight capital coming out of Europe, out of China, out of Japan into U.S. equities. That also pushes up the dollar index. Once we see the dollar break north of 100, and it really confirms that the dollar rally is back on, now international investors will perceive a double whammy effect where not only can they participate with whatever exposure they need to have to equities in the strongest equity market in the world, even if we see it as having some structural problems. It is the best looking house in a lousy neighborhood, the cleanest shirt in a very dirty laundry pile. Well, if you also get the benefit of currency appreciation, you really want to be there if you're an international investor. And that means more and more international capital flows. That further strengthens the dollar. It further boosts the S&P to even loftier levels. Does it all make sense? No. Are there economic fundamentals to support it? No. But the situation is worse in the rest of the world, and I think that flight capital will continue to flow into the United States. And potentially, this is a lot further to go. Now, I'm absolutely convinced that eventually something's got to give, and George Soros and Stan Druckenmiller and all these other guys will be proven right. But you've got to remember, although those are rock stars of finance, they're rock stars of the old normal, back in the day when economic fundamentals were the primary driver of equity prices. Stan Druckenmiller himself has said publicly that one of the reasons he retired is that that style doesn't really work anymore in this new normal where central bank policy drives equity prices. So we don't know how long this can continue before it all falls apart. We know that if we were to have runaway inflation, that would do it because it would tie central bankers' hands. I think that if you look at what's going on in the United States with all of these protests and police shootings and all of the civil unrest that exists, there's less and less tolerance for another banker bailout. So I think that if there is another round of quantitative easing, it probably needs to be helicopter money, not another bank bailout. And that could mean that the Fed's ability to support asset markets directly is compromised at some point. That hasn't happened yet. And until something happens to tie the hands of central bankers, I think there's plenty of room for this thing to go higher. Now, I'm not betting on it. I am not exposed at all to equities in either direction. I don't dare to be long because I think that eventually the bottom has to fall out of this market. I don't dare to be short because I think that the international capital inflow scenario could easily drive things higher. So I'm looking for other things to invest in.
Well, Eric, yeah, I definitely agree on your prognostication. And a stronger U.S. dollar, to me, it just sounds like, you remember the scene in Titanic where people are rushing up to the one part of the Titanic that is yet to sink, but ultimately the whole boat is sinking. But speaking of the old normal versus the new normal, how do you see the indicators that Mr. Dixon talked about in the context of pervasive programmatic or algorithmic trading? I mean, do you think these indicators still have the same efficacy as when they were first established in 1938?
Well, I think that what the Lowry's indicators are measuring is investor sentiment, and that only works on human beings. So it's true that you're measuring the sentiment of human beings. But I think that even though we now have algorithmic traders participating in markets to a much greater extent than ever before, eventually, it is the sentiment of human beings that's going to drive the final outcome. The algorithmic traders just add a whole lot of unnecessary volatility along the way while skimming profits off from the top. We'll talk about that with next week's feature interview guest. But I think the place that there is a difference, it's not so much the presence of algorithmic traders, but it is the difference that what we were measuring in terms of investor sentiment, you know, we're coming into an environment where it's not so much about economic fundamentals anymore, it's about central bank policy. And where central bank policy is the primary driver of equity prices, we have to consider what are the things that are going to change central bank policy. And, you know, there's a lot more curveballs that can be thrown at us. So I think that the indicators are still a very effective way of measuring the sentiment of investors. It's just that the sentiment of investors is maybe not as important as it used to be.
Mm-hmm. So piggybacking off of that and I guess pivoting to a more practical sense, I use a combination of fundamental macro analysis and technical analysis to formulate my own trading ideas. But you've been at this longer than I have, and I'm interested to know how you might implement Mr. Dixon's indicators into your analysis. You know, we've got some great charts and presentations to accompany the interview, so how might our subscribers interpret the charts or interpret the data?
Aaron, my approach is I very much believe that fundamental analysis is the way to decide what trades you want to be in, and technical analysis is the way to decide the timing of the entries and exits. I personally focus almost all of my energy on the fundamental analysis. That's what I'm good at. That's what I enjoy doing. That's where I focus my time. I believe very strongly that technical analysis is extremely powerful at telling me when to time the entry and exits to trades. I try to the extent that I can to rely on people who are better at it than I am. So a service like Lowry's, the buying pressure, selling pressure model, I think is a very effective way of understanding investor sentiment. I also look at technical levels. If you look at something like HedgeEye, it has daily videos where they're just telling you support and resistance levels in all sorts of different asset classes. It's very helpful to me because they're better technicians than I am. I'd much rather let somebody else do that. I mentioned earlier on this program that the 61.8 Fib retracement level on the dollar index is around 97. I didn't measure that myself. I read that someplace. Somebody else did that analysis. So I try to use outside services to give me as many different perspectives as I can on technical analysis, and I integrate that with my own views when I think about things like the reflexive relationship of what happens when international capital flows come into U.S. markets. Well, that's going to put upward pressure on the dollar index. That's going to create an additional incentive for those investors internationally to want to be, okay, that's self-reinforcing. That's the kind of analysis that I do on my own. When it comes to what is that magic number on the dollar index where it's going to accelerate because it's a Fib retracement level, I tend to look to outside analysts to tell me that information.
Great. So I just want to stay on fundamental macro analysis for a second. And so, Eric, recently I've been doing quite a bit of reading on financial history and looking at the Dow Jones Industrial Average since the beginning of the 20th century. And what I found was that in the summers of 29, 87, and 08, leading up to the subsequent crashes, each was preceded by a new high in the index. So how do you think today's market relates to those periods, or do they even relate at all?
Well, I do think that it relates, but you've got to consider, you know, there was a new high in the index, yes, in 1929, but there was a new high in the index in 1928 and probably in 27, too. You know, how do you tell when it's over? There were a lot of people, myself included, in 1998 and 1999 who were saying this tech stock rally is crazy. It was tempting to short tech stocks in 98 and 99, and of course, you would have been totally annihilated had you done that, because there was a blow-off top that didn't really, you know, peter out until 2000. I definitely think that there is similarity to those periods in that we're in a crack-up boom. We're headed to some crazy top, and there will probably be an epic crash, worse than 2008 by a lot. But that doesn't mean it's imminent. It doesn't mean it starts tomorrow. It doesn't mean that now is the time to go short equities. We could easily see the S&P run up several hundred more points as the Fed prints a few trillion more dollars before this thing is over. Eventually, I think that the piper has to be paid, and it's going to be a really ugly, nasty picture. But there's no reason to conclude that it has to happen imminently. And what I focus on is looking for what are the things that would force the Fed's hand? What are the things that would actually cause it to happen imminently? Runaway inflation is one we've talked about in previous episodes of this program. The thing is, there's no sign of runaway inflation right now, and current conditions are much more progenerative of deflation as opposed to inflation. So I don't think that's going to be it anytime soon. Of course, if you keep printing enough money, eventually you will have an inflation problem, but we don't see any signs of it on the horizon right now. I think that if there's a place where maybe what's the wild card that nobody's looking at or that nobody sees coming, it would be the social shift where all of a sudden people will not tolerate allowing the government to bail out Wall Street with more rounds of quantitative easing. They want helicopter money instead. Helicopter money, I think, would be, especially if it's done in size, would be much more inflationary because now you're driving money into the real economy as opposed to just the financial economy. Is that going to happen? When's it going to happen? Nobody knows.
Okay. Well, the last thing I wanted to touch on with you, Eric, was Europe. And right now, everyone is focused on the NPLs, the non-performing loans, and the bail-ins in Italy, and concerned that Deutsche Bank might actually be the next Lehman. Now, I thought it was interesting that Mr. Dixon's analysis showed how Germany's market supply and demand fundamentals were deteriorating as well, including Italy and Spain, despite being held up as a sort of productive stalwart of the region. Do you think there's a sort of market complacency with assessing Germany's true situation? And at a higher level, where might the market blind spot be?
Well, I think that what's going on is that Europe in general, including, I think Germany's economy is definitely stronger than Southern Europe. Certainly, Italy and Spain are really much more likely to have serious problems in their domestic economies. But Germany is also a kingpin of the European Union system. And if the EU itself is at risk, then that creates a tremendous amount of risk to German markets. So I think what you're seeing is the beginning of contagion fears of, holy cow, you know, if the Brexit was just the beginning and Italy and Spain are to follow suit, France, some people in France are talking about a Frexit, you know, everybody's talking about their own version of this.
Exit.
Is it really going to come to fruition, or are these just fears that are going to blow over? I think that's really what's going on. Is there a blind spot? I think the blind spot, again, it comes back to central bank policy. What is going to put the ECB out of business that they can't continue to bail everybody out and paper over all of our problems with printed money? Certainly, if the EU itself started to disintegrate, if more countries were to leave, that could put the ECB's hegemony over European markets at risk. Are there other things that could do it? I'm not sure, but that is the 64 trillion euro question, isn't it?
Yeah, no, that definitely makes sense. And I can see how that would put Germany at risk, since they definitely benefit from the euro system and a weak euro, since they're the largest exporter in the region. So, Eric, that's all I got for questions for this week.
Well, fantastic. I want to just ask our listeners again, folks, we really appreciate the support that you've given us so far with rating and reviewing us on iTunes, retweeting us. It's all very helpful. We hope you'll continue to do it. I think we're really at maybe an inflection point where we're starting to get traction, and we'll be able to bring you more of those big name guests that we all want to get on the program. So you can help us out by retweeting us when we announce the show, telling your friends and colleagues about Macro Voices, forwarding your research roundup emails to your colleagues and friends, and encouraging them to register as well. We really appreciate it, and it helps us to bring you more guests. So, Aaron, for people who have registered at macrovoices.com and have a free account, what can they expect in this week's research roundup email?
Yeah, absolutely. So on top of the great charts and presentations that Mr. Dixon provided, we're bringing to you a recent second half 2016 Outlook presentation from Renaissance Macro, and also the latest perspectives from Richard Bernstein, Andy Rothman of Matthews Asia, and one of my favorite Macro Voices alumni, Axel Merck. Finally, we also include the latest note from Bill Gross, where he happily compares the current global economy's need for credit to a game of Monopoly, where the game can grow and sustain itself on the recurring $200 you get when you pass Go, but only up to a certain point until people start going bankrupt, can't pay the rent, or can no longer keep building their properties. So we've got a fully stacked lineup for you this week in the Research Roundup. Well, that does it for this week's episode. We know our listeners have a variety of interests, and I thought it was great to have someone with more of a technical bent this week. But don't worry, guys, we're not about to become MACD voices, but we hope to bring you a diversity of perspectives so we can better understand the macro environment as a whole. Also, we really appreciate the new followers and retweets. In a few short months, we're nearly at 1,000 followers, and we certainly hope to achieve that many times over. Again, our goal of getting you the high-profile guests you want rests on our ability to reach as many sophisticated investors as possible. So the absolute best way you can help us is by subscribing on macrovoices.com, following us on Twitter at macrovoices, and sharing this podcast with friends and family and colleagues. You can also follow Eric at Eric S. Townsend and myself at underscore Aaron Chan underscore. For Eric Townsend, I'm Aaron Chan. We'll talk to you next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at www.macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week, which never includes advertising or marketing. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we're able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can also subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.